Good afternoon, all. On the day of ApacheCon, I'm glad to introduce my friend Paul King from Azure, who's going to speak about Make Your Testing Groovy. Thank you.
Thank you. So my name is Paul King. I'm one of the Groovy committers. I'm on the PMC, and I've done a lot of things in the Groovy space, a lot of things in testing space. We've been doing Agile since very early days, and quite often have been asked to help organizations get their testing needs sorted. So what I'm going to do today is tell you a little bit about testing with Groovy, some of it about the some nice libraries and techniques and things that are very relevant to the Groovy world, but other things that's more general in nature as well, just some sort of experiences of just applying testing. So we'll get to that. I wear many hats. One of the things that I'm very pleased about lately is that OCI, US-based company that's one of the main proponents behind Grails, now lets me spend some of my time working on Groovy, so thanks to them. If you want any of the slides or code that you'll see on samples, there's some GitHub and SlideShare sites. There you can go and get all that after the fact if you want. So we should perhaps first of all ask, why test with Groovy? And I guess my immediate reaction to that is, well, that's kind of the wrong first question to ask. So I guess as someone who helps build Groovy and so on, it's very easy for me to think, of course, you'd use Groovy everywhere to test everything and build everything. And you'd use it in your build files, your test files, your production code. Use it in your home life or whatever, I don't know, use it to program your TV. But that would be the wrong way to go about thinking about it. What you really need to look at is your organization and see what kind of languages your developers know. What kind of languages do your testers know? Do you have BAs, business analysts, subject matter experts? Do they need to read these tests? Are they going to be involved in creating the tests? And you need to kind of consider all of that and consider the maintenance of your tests. We've gone a very long way in the Agile world, and I don't want to... Agile's probably been carried too far as a brand, and it's perhaps starting to get on the nose in some places, but there's many, many good things about Agile that we've gone a long, long way in terms of making our production code really maintainable and really sweet in terms of nice characteristics and so on. Have we done the same thing with all of our test code and test artifacts? Quite often not. We've often left that way, way behind in terms of lots of manual testing tools and things that we're using, archaic things that we're using. And really, I go into organizations and I try to help them. Let's make testing a first-class thing that you should be trying to do, not just what developers, when their developers are writing tests, but the broader testing picture. Let's get testing moving in all of those spaces. And have a look at that. Look at the maturity levels of the organization, how much automation they've got. Because you can, as many of you who would have doing DevOps stuff will know that you can automate things to an incredible degree these days, and your testing should be part of that story. So ask those questions first. Then come back and say, well, what, you know, is Groovy a good fit for that? I think it happens to think it is in many scenarios. But you need to understand the pros and the cons. So if you've got a Java shop, lots of developers who are familiar with Java, it's an easy win to get them becoming more productive with Groovy. If you've got people who aren't hardcore Java developers, but want something simpler than Java, but you want your other developers to buy into whatever it is that you're going to be using, Groovy's a good option. It allows you to have much simpler things that are very Java-friendly. But if you've got people who already know other languages, it may not be the right choice. If you're not a big user of the JVM at all, it may not be the right choice. So ask these questions first. If you are a Java shop or using the JVM extensively anyway, then I think Groovy is a very good option. In general, I'd say that scripting languages and dynamic languages are a very good option. They tend to lend themselves to writing little mini DSLs, domain-specific languages, that are really, really good for testing. There's a whole lot of other test characteristics that you want to have a look at. I'm not going to go into the details of these, but if you, as software engineers, there's a whole lot of things that we take for granted on the best way to write code and make it scalable and maintainable. Testers also learn a whole lot of stuff about the correct way to test things and so on. And quite often when the two worlds meet, the characteristics of what each side might find important aren't really meshed together, and you need to do that. So there's a whole lot of things that a tester would typically learn as good testing principles. If you go off and start hacking Groovy and forget about all those principles, you're not going to take yourself forward. Okay, so there's a whole lot of things. We're going to come back and look at some things, but there's you really need to look at the people who typically create your tests. Are they used to filling out spreadsheets? Are they used to coding with code? What kind of volumes of data do you've got? How do you maintain that data? How do you relate that back to your test requirements and so on? And there's ways to do that with Groovy and so on. Okay, I'm going to, at the end, and it might be a very whirlwind tour, I've got a little bit to get through, I'm going to look at some testing techniques that testers or developers in the room may not have thought about that are really easy to do once you've got a scripting language there. And so we'll look at that. And I guess there's quite a few things I could talk about, but the main thing that I want to keep pushing is try to automate as much as you can, but without losing track of the important things from a testing point of view, linking back to requirements, getting the right coverage, and so on. I usually find it handy when I'm working out how to go about bringing in something like a scripting language for testing is to map out the different things that I might need to do and start putting in different tools and things that I might want to be using. So I might need to go and test websites. So look at what mechanisms or libraries or utilities can I use to talk to websites? What about talking to databases? What about, you know, this slide is starting to show its age. It's not showing any Docker containers or anything there. But what all the different pillars of the things that I need my testing environment to do, piecing together all the tools that I might want, then piecing together things that, okay, I've got all these as building blocks, I've got techniques and libraries for doing things, I've got various tools that are going to help me create tests easily, and then what am I then going to write my tests in? And it might be Groovy, it might be something else. What am I going to run my tests in? How am I going to organize my tests? How am I going to make sure that I'm efficiently carrying out the tests and only carrying out ones that I need to run? How is anyone going to understand the outcome of running all the tests, the results? Is there going to be some reporting, or how are we going to know what to run? And so I'll typically piece all that together. And often Groovy comes out as something that, at least for me, I can come up with a good solution in nearly all of those blocks and come up with a good thing. So I'm not going to do a tutorial on Groovy today. I've got two slides just sort of give you a flavor, and then we're going to see bits of Groovy. The actual details of the Groovy on the other slides isn't important, but if you've got any questions, by all means, ask me. So if you're trying to think of what Groovy is, you can think of it as a super version of Java. So just take Java and the stuff that makes it hard, all those sharp, pointy angle brackets or whatever, the boilerplate code that we're repeating information to try to keep the compiler happy, things that should be like a built-in design pattern, but you've actually got to go and do it all by hand and do a lot of work. Take all that stuff away and add in first-class functional programming, lots of extensibility, metaprogramming so you can change things if you want. Add in a whole bunch of stuff, and that's what Groovy is. Just one slide on some examples of Groovy. I don't really have time to elaborate this too much, but I'll do a couple of the lines out of here. System out print line, hello world, that's the kind of thing you might see in a hello world Java program as one of the lines in that, along with a bunch of other boilerplate. You can do the same thing in Groovy, that's fine, or you can do a shorthand version print line hello world. It amounts to exactly the same thing. What else might be useful? Groovy defaults to big decimal arithmetic, but if you don't want that, you can switch it off. What that means is in the financial world, when you've got tests that are testing money and things like that, you don't get rounding errors. In very few languages will these two statements here both run as you'd expect. asserting a half equals 1 divided by 2 in most programming languages will not return true. So Groovy does the right thing from our financial world in terms of the results that it does. Using big decimal everywhere, when if you've got fractions, isn't necessarily super efficient, so you can turn all that off when you, if you want to. Some other things that may or may not be obvious to people, this is defining a variable called pets that's in a list of strings. So this is a literal list syntax. And what can we do on a list of strings? What we can do is for each of the strings in that list, run a bit of code. This bit of code is going to make sure that the particular string, the pet, comes before dog in the alphabet lexicographically. Yep. So we can work with code like that as a closure. So that's the whirlwind tour of Groovy. But as I said, if you see something on a slide and you don't have a clue, what's that? Stick your hand up and I can try to explain it as we go. Yep. So some of my slides will be interesting to developers. So it's how to organize and run tests and some of the frameworks that you can use. I'll try to go through that pretty quickly. I mean, I could do the whole talk on that or I could do the whole talk on this, but we don't have a lot of time today. So I'll try to get through this quickly so that I can show some of the stuff that I'm trying to highlight. So let's first of all look at how would you organize and run tests. Now this is starting from a developer mindset. So this would be, I've written some code and I want to make sure that code does the right thing, okay? So you can think of this as starting off at unit testing level and we're going to sort of get broader and broader as we go along. So the first option I've got there is none. So you might think, what? Sacrilege. How can you tell us you don't want to go use a testing framework? What are you talking about? Well, Groovy deems testing so important that it actually comes with lots of testing stuff built in out of the box. So in fact, even though I'm saying none, you actually get stuff bundled in. So what I'm saying is if I'm starting to use Groovy, I can do a lot of things without even thinking about a testing framework. And you'll see that on the next slide. But basically, assertions are built in and turned on by default. Things like mocks and Groovy JUnit test 3 style test cases, JUnit 4 type things are just bundled into Groovy. So they're going to be there even in your production code. So Groovy's going to have that there, and if you need to use it, you can use it. You can make fancy assertions in prod code if that's the right thing to do. Groovy deems that to be important enough that it's there. And we'll look at these other ones very briefly as we go. So let's now have a little example just to give you a feel for how this thing looks. Here I've got some code. It's a converter between Celsius and Fahrenheit. I think there's still one or two countries in the world that use Fahrenheit, is that right? Not sure. I'm going to feed in a Fahrenheit value and I'm going to convert it to Celsius. There's a standard formula for doing that, for those of you who memorize that and do that all the time in your head. And what I'm going to do now is assert 20 equals Celsius of 68. And so it's going to call that method that I've statically imported. It'll run that code, and if that assertion is false, it'll complain, and if it's true, it'll be happy. So there's no tests anywhere here, no testing framework apparent. So this is just normal code, and so you can have assertions. So you can have assertions in your prod code, and there are times when that's a very useful thing to do. It takes up a small amount of cycles to do it, but it's often better to have some assertion throw an error than have some really confusing error message that pops up in production very, very rarely, but when it does, you've got no clue what it's doing. So having a few assertions here and there in your prod code is not necessarily a bad thing. It has its place. Okay, we've got a few more. There's a little two integer here. This particular value doesn't return a whole number. I wanted to compare it to a whole number, so I rounded it down and everybody's happy. Now, what happens if you get something wrong? So in fact, Celsius of 95 is 35, and I'm trying to test it's 34. Maybe my test is wrong, maybe my converter is wrong, who knows? But when you get something wrong, Groovy's got it's known as a power assert mechanism, which basically spits out a representation of the thing that failed and lets you know what's going on. That's a very simple example. There's a more elaborate one. You probably can't see what's happening down the back, but there's just a mathematical expression here. I've got 2 to the power of 16 divided by blah, blah, blah. And this fails, but what I can see is that, oh yeah, 2 to the power of 16 is this value here, and 4 to the power of 3 is this value here, and when I divide those two, I get this. Oh, okay, that's all looks good to me. And then you can work your way along the equation and see what all the different bits are, and eventually you say, well, that's where I've gone wrong. This value here is the wrong value, and you can nut that out. Now, this is just numbers, but these can be objects and strings and regexes and other things, and they'll print out strings and things in this little list, whatever you've got. So that's a very handy thing to have. And that's, again, out of the box, you get that built in. One of the frameworks that I'm going to talk about called Spock has a slightly tweaked, revamped version of this, so it's even adds a few more things to it. Now, you can just go and use normal JUnit 3 type tests, and they will run out of the box in Groovy. So if you're in the Java world, it can often be hard to know how to run a test. You've got to have some sort of way to kick it off from the command line. You've got to go always look it up, or you've got to have a build framework, a Maven or a Gradle or something that's going to kick off the testing framework for you. Groovy deems tests to be important enough that it's got built-in runners for tests. So if you pop up in a Groovy console, which is one of the things that comes with Groovy, at the risk of not coming back to my display page. Let's hope I don't totally muck up the display. This is the Groovy console running that assert that we saw before. So if you go and type in any Groovy code in there and just hit run, the result of running that code appears down the bottom. And you can just cut and paste any test case that you see. So go and get a JUnit test case, a JUnit 4 test case, a TestNG test case, JUnit 5 with some caveats. Paste it in here and run it, and the result of running the test shows straight away. You don't need to have a complicated mechanism for... and it did muck up. Is this the right one? Come on, you can do it. Okay, we're back. I'll try not to do that too often. And that's just going to run. So Groovy test case is just a class that extends the JUnit 3 one and adds a whole bunch of bells and whistles. I'm not going to go through all those. It's well documented extra things that it adds for you. But there's some very nice things for doing various kinds of additional stuff. And there's Groovy's got a logging test case. It's got stuff for doing things, fancy things with test suites and other stuff. JUnit 4, you just simply put the JUnit, use the JUnit 4 style. You annotate a test with the test annotation, and that'll just run. Again, it'll run directly in the console if you want. JUnit 5, this is still an alpha thing. It won't run out of the box. At the moment, Groovy doesn't bundle JUnit 5 in its... if you go and get a binary version of it. So you've got to go and get the library. Now, I don't think I've mentioned in this talk... I've had three talks in a row. I'm trying to remember which things I've mentioned in which talks. Groovy's got a nice little thing called grab, which is an annotation that if you put it in your class, it makes it a self-contained script that goes and gets all the dependencies that the script might have. So this is really handy if you just want to have a self-contained script. You might want to email it to someone and say, hey, run this. Why is it showing this result? All the dependencies that this particular thing have are spelt out inside the script itself. Now, if you're using Maven or Gradle or something and you're specifying your dependencies elsewhere, you wouldn't ever need to see that. But if you want to have it self-contained, you can put that sort of thing in. So in this case, I'm grabbing JUnit 5, the snapshot versions that are the milestone versions that are out there. And then I'm going to go use it, and I'm using a special JUnit 4 runner version of it that still lets me run it from something that's aware of JUnit 4, and Groovy's aware of JUnit 4, so it goes and runs these things for you. Okay, well, okay, I'm going to come back to just note here that we've got a bunch of different test cases, freezing, boiling, and you can think of other things that you might want to test. You start getting a large number of tests here with hard-coded values inside them. That can be a bit hard to maintain and understand what's going on. We're going to see a way to get rid of that sort of stuff shortly. So as well as the JUnit family, there's TestNG as another framework that you can go use. I haven't got in the website, you'll see examples of that. I didn't put any slides of that up. So that's something else you can use. What's most popular out of all of those frameworks in the Groovy world, I guess JUnit 4 is pretty popular, but a lot of Groovy people start to use Spock as their testing framework. And it's something that's fully compatible with JUnit 4, but extends it in a number of different ways. And this is a Spock test. And what it does is it starts to tease out, if you're familiar with behavior-driven development, it's a style of structuring your tests that help tease apart the different parts of a test. So often you can have a test with a big complicated chunk of code that's doing a whole range of different things, and you don't know what parts of that test are actually just setup type code, what parts of it are the thing you're actually interested in, and what parts might be tearing stuff down or whatever. Doing a BDD style helps tease out those different concerns, and you can Spock lets you put nice English-friendly names on your tests as well. So test adding a new item to a set. Here I go and define a set. That's sort of setting everything up. When I add a new item to this set, then I'm expecting the size to increase to 5. Yep. So this given when then and this sort of structuring and helps you organize things and enables you to present things to non-developer people quite readily. So I've got whole talks on Groovy DSLs, and I've got maybe a chance to show you some stuff at the very end. I'm not sure. But what we'll often end up having is code that looks like this with little testing DSL sort of statements appearing inside here. And these testing DSL sort of statements are English-looking statements that are invoking some code behind the scenes. So all the code to talk to databases, talk to websites, whatever, gets hidden behind things that look like a few words in English or some other language, whatever you're wanting to capture things in. And then this becomes the sort of thing that I can show to a business analyst or a subject matter expert rather than showing them big globs, 100 lines of code and sort of stuff. And the reporting that you get out of Spock with the nice friendly names can also be the kind of thing that you can present to someone. Look, all the tests ran and here's the results, and we're confident that we've captured everything. Okay, so I mentioned before that one of the things that you don't necessarily want to do is have all those hard-coded values in lots of different tests. It can be hard to maintain and remember what's what, and it doesn't lend itself to showing a business analyst or subject matter expert the cases that you've got covered. You might want to pull stuff like this out of a spreadsheet or a CSV file or something. Parameterization of your test is a mechanism to do that. JUnit 4, TestNG, Spock all have ways to do parameterized testing. And we'll look at just a couple of those. So this one's JUnit 4. That's not all that important. But basically, there's a mechanism by which I can specify a bunch of case studies, test values, if you like, feed them into my tests, and then run my tests. Okay. I'll show you some of the results of running some things shortly. Here is the same thing in Spock. Spock lets you do a nice little tabular format. So this is just normal Groovy code, and Spock does some fancy stuff underneath the covers to convert this into asserts of all the different data. And so here I'm just saying, expect the Celsius of my temperature in Fahrenheit to equal the temperature in Celsius. Okay, the temperature in Celsius is coming from this column in this table looking thing here, and the temperature in Fahrenheit from this column in the table. This particular scenario is just something that can be useful when I'm printing out, when I want to talk about a particular row in that data there. Now, if I go and run this in my normal IDE or whatever, it runs as a single test, but there's a feature in Spock to unroll this test. So if I put an unroll annotation here, and I can actually now start to put in placeholder markers inside the string that I give as the name of the method that get populated with, so temperature and Fahrenheit actually gets fed into the name of the method that's going to run. I can just tweak that slightly, and now when I run it, it starts showing up the different test cases with nice friendly English names. And so I can see here, the scenario for beach conditions failed, and I can go and look at, I happen to feed in the wrong value on purpose in this particular case to show up there. I've fed in 34 instead of 35, whatever it was, and this particular one has now shown up as an error. We could go and check, is the test wrong? Is the code wrong? What's going on here? And this is the kind of thing that I can show to my subject matter experts and say, what should the beach conditions scenario be for this particular converter or whatever? Okay, so one of the features that developers are going to be particularly interested in is mocking. So Groovy's got mocking built in. It's got a very powerful, it's based around dynamic metaprogramming. It actually alters the behavior of dummy objects in such a way that they can act as mocks or stubs in your tests. And that's built in. But Spock has gone and taken mocking to the next level, I would think. And it's actually got a nice little notation for doing things. I don't want to spend too long on this because we've got other things to talk about. But a mock is just a dummy object that's going to take the place of a real object in your code so that you can do isolated tests. Okay, so if I've got a whole bunch of objects in my domain that are all connected together, and I'm trying to run a test, and I'm poking one of them that I can get to, and something's going wrong, I'm never sure, is it the object that I'm trying to test, or is it one of the helper objects that's plugged into the side anywhere? So what you do is you plug mocks in everywhere, get the mocks acting in the way that they're supposed to what happen, and you can test in isolation then just the way that your class under test is interacting with all of its helper objects, and you're testing just its behavior. And you typically want to have some tests like this and some tests that are doing end-to-end testing. Now, in this particular case, we're trying to book tickets to Lord of the Rings. We're trying to book a couple of tickets, and we're going to create a mock for the theater. And given we've set up the theater this way, when I try to purchase a ticket for in a particular theater, then after that method's called, what I want to check is that the purchase has been completed, and that theater.purchaseTicket got called once with those parameters. Okay, so this is now testing how the object under test is interacting with its environment. And there's a cardinality, and there's things you can plug in there. You can easily go look at that up if you're interested in. You can plug in wildcards. So here I'm saying, I want to check that has seats available. When this is called with any values, if you return false, right, so we're saying there's no seats available, then we want to make sure that the ticket doesn't ever get bought, and we want to make sure that purchase ticket never completes, never gets called. And you can put enclosures in here and do fancy things. So we've got couples tonight. Couples doesn't have to be a male or female. It can be, it doesn't specify that. All it says is that two people have bought a ticket. So what this is doing is on couples night, when tickets are purchased, it makes sure that every time tickets are purchased, the number of tickets purchased is always divisible by two. I don't know why we'd want to test that, but this can be any arbitrary expression there, and that just showing some of the power of that mocking framework. Okay, there's another aspect that often becomes visible in many of the testing frameworks in the Java world, and that's what's called assertion frameworks. So you might have seen something like this in JUnit 3, some early fragments of it. You might have heard of Hamcrest or Fest or Google Truth. And they, if you've ever seen things like Assert That and so on, there's a bunch of frameworks like that that exist. In Groovy, it's actually a bit of an anti-pattern if you start using any of these. So in our prod code, we have ways in which we would get collections of things or check that nothing, you know. Here I've got this is Google Truth. And we've gone and created a set of colors, the Google colors in the banner. And we want to check that those colors contains none of pink, black, white, or orange. And what they've gone and done in their testing, in their assertion framework, is created a whole bunch of methods here that allow you to have nice compact tests. Groovy would sort of say, well, that's backwards. Your language should be powerful enough to do a test like that in prod that's very succinct, and you should do the same thing in test code. It's not necessarily the same code, but you should use the power of the language to do this sort of thing. So in Groovy, you wouldn't use one of these. You'd typically just say, well, assert that for any of these colors, it's not the case that any of them are in the Google colors. And that's the thing you'd put in your, that's how you'd write it if you were doing prod code that needed to do a test like that. And so test code should have the same ability to specify something like that. And with Groovy's power assert, you're going to get nice, meaningful expansion of that if something goes wrong. And so it's a win-win. Now, in the agile world, again, this is still in developer mindset here. If you're doing test-driven development, you kind of play a little game. If you've ever heard never write a single line of production code without a failing test and things like that, there's when you're doing pair programming in the agile world, you're trying really, really hard to have nice, clean, succinct code. And it's a nice little game you play where if you split into pairs, someone will write test code and then someone will write the production code just minimal enough just to make that test pass and nothing more. And if you get good at doing this, you can go back and forth doing this and you end up with minimal test code and minimal production code and 100% code coverage if you do it in the right way. And I spent many years doing this, and kind of when I started doing stuff in the functional world, they never used this. And it turns out that because in the imperative world, when we're using this technique, we're kind of doing gray box testing. We kind of know what's going to be inside the thing that we're testing, and we feed in values that we pick out that we know are going to test every branch and every path. If there's an if then else, we'll make sure that both the positive and the negative branches are going to get tested, and we'll write just the minimum number of tests to force all that to happen. When you go to the world of functional programming, it's all you're trying to be no state, side effect free, whatever. There is no gray box in there that you can poke at. And so you tend not to do it this way. And you tend to move over to a different style of testing. You can still do end-to-end functional testing the same as you would do an end-to-end test in an imperative system. That's fine. But at other levels of your system, instead of doing the kind of thing you would do in TDD, you validate certain properties. And here's just an example of the kind of thing you'd do. This is using Quick Check for Java. And I haven't shown you all the imports, but I've statically imported some methods in that framework for words in some non-empty list. So some non-empty list is a factory method that just generates on demand a bunch of lists, and they're all non-empty lists because of the one I've called. And then I'm going to run this assertion on them. So what I'm going to assert is when I take all those words, if I've got 10 words, I'll get the size of each word and add those numbers up. That should be the same as if I take those words and concatenate them all together and then take the size of the whole thing. Right? And what a property-based testing framework is, it'll run an assertion like that and it'll do it 100 times, 1,000 times, 1,000,000 times for randomly generated values. And when I say randomly generated values, you can have some control over what gets generated. Why would we do that, and how would we do that, and how does this make sense? Well, sometimes, I'm going to do this for the Celsius converter. This is what you might do. So sometimes you'll have an oracle to go and check against. So for a Celsius converter, I might know I've got another library that does those conversions, and I'm pretty sure it's okay. I'm going to test my library against this other library. In that case, you can just generate random data, check that what your library and the other library return the same results. You might have an online website you can go to and query this thing. So sometimes you'll have an oracle. Sometimes you can determine the data some other way. There might be some database you can look up. There might be various techniques that you can use. But quite often, you'll abandon the goal in TDD that were on the previous slide was we're going to have the minimal set of test suites that make sure we cover everything. You abandon that goal altogether, and you instead say, actually, you know, I really can't be sure that I can find some sort of minimal set of data. I'm going to abandon that goal and just get random data, and I can't actually test the exact value that comes back because I don't know what it should be, but I can validate certain properties about it. I'll assert certain conditions about the test. So in this particular case, I'm going to generate integers between minus 40 and 240. I've got a range of temperatures for liquid in Celsius and for liquid in Fahrenheit. I know that this is freezing and boiling. So anything that's in between these things, I don't know if I'm actually at zero, maybe it's not liquid, but anyway, we'll ignore the one right on the boundary case. And what I'm going to do is 100 times, go to my generator that's got random numbers and get another value, and I'm going to call it on my function, and I don't know what result this should be, so what am I going to do? I'm actually going to check that Celsius should always be less than or equal to Fahrenheit, and that's true in this range. So we'll better make sure that's at least true, because if that's wrong, then I'd get my converter's doing something wacky. And I'm also going to check another thing. What it should be the case is if it's liquid when it's in the Celsius temperature range, it better be liquid when it's in the Fahrenheit range as well. So here's some condition that I can work out that where I can pass in thousands. I'm doing 100 here, but I could pass in 100, 1,000, a million, and I'm going to make sure this property holds. And it doesn't guarantee that there's some value that I didn't test that may come out wrong, but it gives me confidence. I know that any converter, these properties should hold. And something else that I might want to do is if I feed in two temperatures, that both in Celsius and convert in Fahrenheit and convert them, if one of them was bigger than the other one when I fed them in, the Celsius should be bigger than the other one I fed them out. So that's another property I could go test. So if I go and pick random values and a bigger Celsius value comes back as a smaller Fahrenheit value, wow, something wacky's going on and I've screwed up somewhere. So this is what properties-based testing is all about. And it might look like, I'm not sure how I would apply that. Turns out that you can build what's called generators and you can go and populate, this is a thing called Spock Genesis. So this happens to be one that specifically lets you do a whole bunch of stuff with the Spock framework that I talked about. I haven't got the Celsius example on this slide, but anyway, I'll whack that on the website. I'll whack that together and put it on the website shortly. This shows you that all your domain objects, you can go and populate those with values that make sense for your domain. And then you just go and run thousands of different tests on your domain objects, which are populated with values that you expect. And there's things for doing. You can populate strings of the regex type expressions, ranges, conditions. A lot of these frameworks have, you can pick I don't know why you'd want this, but suppose you're doing a website that you think teenagers are going to be attracted to. You can have an age integer generator that picks some sort of Gaussian distribution for age. And so you'll get your test data can be indicative of the kind of people that might come to your website. Okay. So what I wanted to do now is flip over to looking more at testing, end-to-end testing of systems. And the example that I'm going to use is a little blogging system. And this is one that happens to be, if you're interested in Groovy, the thing that's running this is interesting. It's a single script that has GORM and a whole bunch of other stuff inside it, and it's not very many lines long, and it's a complete blogging system, but that's not relevant for today. It just happens to be a blogging system on a little website, which you can create a new blog entry or see existing ones. It's not meant to look pretty, because I'm not trying to get you distracted on that. And you can go and create a new post. You enter in some values. You can give it a category, an author, a title, and put in some content, and then do create post. And it'll add that post, and it'll appear on the front page. Now, so that's a website. How could we go and test this? Well, I actually don't need a testing framework. I don't need any drivers. I can just write a little bit of Groovy code that goes to a page, pulls down all the text, and checks some contents on it. So the first one is checking for an exact match of a string. The second one, it's doing a bit of a regex pattern match on that amounts to the same thing, but would be a bit more flexible if that's what I'm trying to do. Done. So I can actually write this sort of stuff in Groovy. Now, this is a long way from the DSL type stuff I'm saying you should head towards, so let's not pause on this too long, but the point here is that you don't necessarily need anything else apart from a language to do this, and what you could do is start turning this sort of code into a little DSL later on. Probably what you want is something that, because you're going to be interacting with lots of web pages or whatever it is that you're testing, you probably want something that's a bit smarter. The first thing is, out of the box, I can go and use the XML parser. If I've got HTML-compliant, XHTML code or whatever that's compliant to XML, then I'll be able to parse it in Groovy, and I can do some smarter things. Typically, HTML isn't very compliant. It can often have lots of stuff in it, so there's various libraries around for pulling stuff out and making it look as if it's compliant. It parses things. There's a bunch of libraries that do that. That's just one example there. This is one using HTTP Builder. So this starts letting me do some fancier things when I'm posting blog entries, and still lets me pull stuff back as well. And so the stuff that's on here is not really important. And this one happens to be using Ant calling out, so Apache Ant's calling out to a testing framework called WebTest. Haven't used this for a little while now, but this is Groovy code here. It's starting to now look a bit more friendly. This is starting to look like more testing DSL sort of stuff that I could put in front of my subject matter experts and so on. So I can verify that, you know, I'm invoking a URL, verifying the title, clicking a button, and so on. And once you start using these sorts of tools, you can start getting pretty reporting. And you can sort of see what things worked and what things didn't work. And so this is sort of the direction that you can take this in, and it's still using Groovy underneath the covers to do all this sort of code. Okay, and there's nice tools and things. I'm not going to... I could do a whole talk on just these tools, but let's not. Here's another example using Spock to test that same thing, and I'm using the parameterization here. And I get nice little reporting happening here. So when Bart posts a home blog with content foo, it should succeed or whatever. And so there's various things that I can be using here. Again, this isn't the full DSL yet. This is some sort of partial step towards where we'd like to be. I probably won't get time to show you final things of where we're going to like to be. But if you're interested in that case study and a whole bunch of tools that you could use, the website that was on the front page has, 20-odd, maybe a couple more, frameworks, and you won't be able to see the names of them, but if you go to the website, you'll see it all, and you can go and check how you would test that particular thing using those things. So there's Selenium, WebDriver, Robot Framework, JBehave, all sorts of things there. If you want to see how, Jeb, if you want to see how you would test EasyB, test using those, you can go and have a look at those. Okay, now I'm going to risk... I'm actually going to swap to a different deck very quickly. Hopefully we're still good. Okay, so what I'm going to do now is talk about some of the techniques that you can use. And you can still have all those frameworks and other things. You can still have web tests or Selenium or WebDriver underneath the covers. But because you're now, because I'm moving my tests to be using a scripting language, there's a whole lot of things that library calls and things that I can do that allow me to do smart things that are kind of nice. And these are things that, because I'm in a scripting language rather than some sort of tool where I have to manually click on things and create tests that way, there's just a whole range of things that I can do. And we're going to have a look at some of those. And this is, in some ways, just to sort of turn on light bulbs, you know, get out of the rut that you might be in of, we always test it this way, we only do this, we only do that, and gosh, we seem to be repeating ourselves all the time and so on. So the first thing I can do is a thing called combinations. So in this particular case, I've got an example where I've got operating systems, hard drive sizes, and memory disk sizes, but that's just an artificial example I've created. But what I can do is, here I've got three different operating systems, three different memory sizes, three different hard disk sizes, and if I do just dot combinations.each, then every single one of the combinations of all of those will be invoked on my test method here. Yep. And because I'm in scripting languages, it's really easy to do. Now, don't think operating systems, memory, and hard disk. Think drop-down box with four values, you know, where the buttons, whether things are clicked on the page, the text values within a page, and so on. They might be the things I'm testing against, and find all the combinations of those and do a test. And this will be tests will be run. And I didn't have to go and write 36 tests in my code and try to maintain that. If I want to, imagine I would now decide there's new memory size out, I want to go and add that. Imagine the pain of having to go through and work out, you know, where do I need to add it? Which ones should I delete? Should we stop supporting 2 gig ones? I don't make those anymore. It's really easy if you've got it in tabular form just to change it, and your tests will now be up to date rather than having to go find all the tests that were relevant for that. And if it's not in code and it's hard, you've pointed and clicked using a tool in you know, some sort of fancy tool that you've got, it's hard as well. Now, this combinations is a little bit inefficient. We can do the same thing for Bart. For our little blog, we've got Bart, Homer, and so on. We've got different categories they could have picked. Here we can go get 75 combos. So that's just that blogging thing again. But it turns out that errors in your system tend to typically be when two particular factors are interacting. Sometimes it's more than two, and you can actually have an all pairs that's not just binary. You can have a one that spans more than just the two axes. But it's typically, you know, it's, gosh, when I've got that big disk size and the small memory size, when those two things interact, that's when hell breaks loose. So it's when they enter in the, you know, when they have the save my password button checked and they have a blank password. It's that, the combination of those two things that causes the bug. It doesn't matter what the other values might be, right? So what all pairs does is it says, rather than doing all the combinations, we're just going to make sure that every pair that can be possibly different occurs at least once in the combinations that I produce. Does that make sense? So looking at this, going back to our operating systems, Windows 95 appears with 256 megs and 128 and 64, but it also appears with disk database sizes of 100, 5,000 and 20,000. Actually, this is doing... Yeah, that's right, because I'm swapping the ordering of these in each case, yeah. So you can see here, Unix has all three. Windows 95 has all three. Windows 2000 has all three. But if I go and look at 64 megs, you'll see it lines up once with the big database, coming down here, once with the medium database, and once with the small database. So each operating system gets every single possible memory size. Each memory size gets every single database size, and similarly between operating systems and databases. Does that make sense? So an all pairs framework does all combinations, but shrinks it down to just now handling the cases that are likely to trigger errors. And that's the code if you want to write your own all pairs, but you can go get libraries depending on what you're interested in doing. And now, instead of having those 75 combinations, we've only got 18. Okay, so now my tests are going to run faster, but every single aspect of interest has been tested with every other aspect of interest. So by you, and because I'm assuming I've got the all pairs library already rewritten, and you've got one on the slides if you haven't got one already, I change, instead of going dot combinations, I go dot all pairs. So I've changed it a couple of characters in my tests, and all of a sudden I've got this efficiency going from 75 down to 18. And if you've got more, I've got three things here having only a small number of values, this could potentially be millions going down to hundreds, right? So this can save you an enormous amount of times, and still, we'll pick out the things that are of interest. Now, the fancy all pairs libraries will actually let you go beyond just making sure everything's covered. You can actually hint to the framework as, oh, this variable is super important, test it with everything. Or you can start to ask it to give you priorities and percentages and weights and things on the different frameworks. This particular example shows you how we can use some of the parallelization capabilities in Groovy for testing that web blog. I probably don't want to spend too long on doing it, but here we've got some test cases, and we go and run it, and it's going to spread it across all my cores and run it. Okay, I'm not going to do anything fancy with that. Now, one of the things that you may not have thought of doing when you're doing your testing is using something like constraint programming or logic programming. And there's a whole bunch of libraries in Groovy for doing that. And I've had a couple of customers where this has been really key for making sure that we get coverage of certain kinds of things in their test suites that they never before had a way of working out how they would get those sorts of tests in there. Now, I'm going to skip over the general case and come straight into the blog. So this is something that's cropped up when people are doing some the real example is doing analysis of web server stats of various things, but converting that into something related to this blog, what they've gone and done is they found some information that no one who uses this blog ever blog on the same day. Marge blogs only on a Saturday or Sunday. Maggie blogs only on a Tuesday or Thursday, and so on. So they've got certain properties that from the stats they can pull out, and they can list all those down. And you piece all that together, you feed it into a constraint programming framework. I'm using one called Choco. And you add in constraints that say Lisa's, so Bart blogs only on the day after Lisa. So we feed in that Lisa plus day one is going to be a constraint that's equals to Bart. So Bart's a variable on telling it which days Bart's going to blog on. Anyway, you feed in all these constraints, the details aren't really important, and you run it, and it says, aha, these are the actual solutions for that match up, these are the possibilities that match up with the characteristics that we've determined. And so now you run test cases that involve just these things. Okay, and you've gone and used some smart logic solutions behind the covers to work out what those values are. And the nice thing is, you don't go and work this out once. You don't bring the consultant in who works this out, and then you hard code five test cases into your test suite. You have the logic programming there. Later on, when one of those constraints changes, oh, you found Bart only blogs on the day after Lee, so a year later, you could do your stats again, and now Bart only blogs on the day before. You change that constraint, And now you get the new generated set of things that, that make sense for your system. And so keeping it all as a scripting language just allows you to have that sort of sitting there. I've got things that are calling out to closure to solve that same sort of thing, but we'll skip that. Okay. Is it 5 minutes I've got, or? Okay. Good. So I think this is probably the last one I wanted to talk about. And there's a another thing that, you, again, I've probably never thought of, that, but actually in, for some of my customers, we've got some telcos and other things where this is really important. It's a way of testing that they'd never thought of, but is, again, really easy to do, and scripting makes it really easy. I'm using a thing called Model JUnit. And that turns out to be what you do is you create a little finite state machine in code that represents your system. So you can think of a vending machine that you might need to enter in a dollar. You can put in four quarters, or you can put in a dollar coin or whatever, depending on what coins your country supports, 5 20-cent pieces in Australia maybe. You feed that in as information in a state machine, and then you just tell the state machine to run. And it goes and caters for all the different possible ways to traverse through your system. Okay, so that's the coin one. We'll skip over that and get straight into the... So we've gone and done that for... We've created a little state machine for our blogging system, representing the kinds of things that... This represents the order in which they filled out the drop-down boxes. So did they put the drop-down box for category before or after the other one, and so on. And so we've fed all this into a state machine, and then we've gone and said run and test it. And so it's going and running this state machine, going through all the possibilities. Let's do the category first, and then do the whoever the user. Now let's do the user first, and then the category. Let's fill out random text in here and leave this one blank, and so on. And this goes and does it. It runs multi-thousand lines of code, and then it prints out nice little pretty graphs that show you did. So I got to choose here. You can't see it in here, but I got to choose, go and generate, step through the state machine 50 times, just, and I can change this number. But because it did 50, you can see them there, I've run it multiple times, which is why there's this many, I then get little pretty graphs that show me the combinations of, here's how far through all the different possible combinations I've traversed. Did I actually get everywhere? Did every single way traversing through my system get covered or not? And I get little graphs that show me whether I succeeded or not. Okay. And I think that's it.
Would it be possible to create a test suite for a compiler based on something like that? Because we have a compiler that's very, tested very little.
It is, but I'm not saying it's going to be easy. So there's a whole chapter on testing in Groovy in Action if you're interested. Otherwise, by all means, many of the people on the Groovy mailing list are very keen advocates of agile or various testing frameworks or of various sort of functional programming style testing as well. So. Come along to the Groovy and fire your questions at us. We're happy to answer any. Okay, thanks very much. Do we have any questions? Or?
Any questions?
Yes.
So you mentioned tooling support for Groovy.
So on tooling support, is there a particular IDE you'd favor that works best with all these things? Or some of them?
IntelliJ. So Eclipse used to be pretty good, but it's a, kind of a sad story at the moment. So Pivotal haven't been maintaining the Eclipse plugin, and we're all struggling to keep it maintained. So the IntelliJ one, the IntelliJ guys have been super great in terms of having really good support for Groovy. So...
Any questions?
Okay, thanks everyone, and come and see me afterwards if you've got any other questions. Thanks.
Thank you all.